All right, we'll give about 30 seconds for the last people to trickle in, and then we'll go ahead and get started. Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our October 2022 State of the Economy call with Gene McGowan. My name is Michael Gibb. I'm going to be administering the call today. I do have a few housekeeping items before we begin, but I'm going to be brief because we do have a lot to cover today, and we've received a good number of questions, so I'm going to try and get Gene to be able to answer those today. Due to the timing of the call and complexity of what's going on in the market right now, this call is a replacement for our September newsletter. We just couldn't cover everything in a single page. So if you've been on the lookout for that, please keep that in mind. We'll resume our normal newsletter cycle in October. Today's call is going to follow the same format as our previous call. So Gene will give her prepared remarks. If any questions come up during her remarks, please pass those questions on to me, and I will send them to Gene after her prepared remarks to address so that everyone can hear her point of view on that. And then lastly, before we begin, I do want to express our support for our clients who were affected by Hurricane Ian. We do have a lot of clients down in Florida that were affected. And if there's anything at all we can do to help during this time, please don't hesitate to reach out to us. But with that, I'll stop talking and I will turn it over to Gene.
Fantastic. Thank you, Michael. I'm really looking forward to this. And Michael laid down a challenge for me to get through the material in a timely manner so we can get to your questions. But if for some reason I go long, I will certainly respond to any questions after the call. Before I share the slides, I just thought I'd make a few comments. You know, there's a lot going on both in the economy and market. So I thought I would just highlight some of the key themes that we're going to dig into today and just give you that upfront, you know, the areas that we're going to cover before we hit the detail. So I think, you know, one of the first important things is that we do not believe that we're in a recession currently. I know we've had two quarters of negative growth, but there are other factors going on in the economy that would call into question whether we're truly in a recession. Now, having said that, the Fed is very aggressive. Inflation has been persistent. And we do see the risk of a recession as we go into 2023. And we'll certainly talk about that more later. Secondly, we're seeing some signs that inflation is peaking. But there are areas of inflation that are still a concern, some stickier components, and we'll talk a lot about that as we go through the slides. Third, you know, the Fed, we'll talk about the Fed. They were obviously late in the process of removing policy accommodation, and that has caused them to have to move a lot faster, and we'll address that and what we think about the outlook for the Fed. The fourth main theme is really just one of economic uncertainty and financial market uncertainty. You know, and it's just important to remember that equity markets and the economy go through cycles over time. And that's what we're seeing now. Equity cycles tend to lead economic cycles. And we're experiencing that negative part of the equity cycle right now. And there's the potential that we'll see the negative part of the business cycle into next year. And then finally, the other key point that I hope you get out of today's call is that while we are experiencing negative returns both in equity and bond markets, your portfolios are positioned in a defensive manner. Our strategy remains to focus on high quality market leading companies with the ability to work through difficult economic times and position themselves well for the future. So we may make some changes to the portfolio over the next quarter to take advantage of some market dislocations, but we're not going to change that focus on the fundamentals. And we want to make sure that we have companies that can meet a long-term growth criteria. And, you know, we don't want to feed into near-term uncertainty or anxiety in the market. So with that, I'm going to share my screen and start talking about some of the slides and economic data that we are looking at. Okay, so you should all be seeing the slides, I hope. So moving to page 2, this is just a real quick view of you know, where we are today and all of the different factors that are impacting economic uncertainty. And I think there's some factors that we would call leaning towards recessionary, and some that we would highlight that are supporting moderate growth going forward. You know, obviously in the latter category, broad-based and persistent inflation is an issue. The aggressive monetary action from the Fed is certainly, while focused on reducing inflation, has the ability to slow the economy and lead us towards a recession. We're still dealing with supply chain disruptions that have been occurring really since the beginning of the COVID pandemic. They are getting better. You know, we are seeing labor shortages in some areas that are also inflationary and potentially recessionary. And then obviously the one that we can't control, the war in Ukraine, which is disrupting global food and energy markets and just causing global uncertainty. On the positive side, the labor market remains healthy. We're adding new jobs every month. There are still pockets of disruption in the labor market that are leading to higher inflation, but in general, we have a healthy labor market. The manufacturing sector, whether you talk about goods manufacturing or services, is still expanding. It's not expanding as fast as it was a couple months ago, but we're still seeing that push from manufacturing that's supported by consumer demand. We've talked in previous calls about the consumer shifting their buying preferences from goods to services, and that relationship is starting to normalize where we're seeing less spending on goods and more on services. And that's not only supporting economic growth, but it's also helping to get the economy back into more balance in terms of supply and demand. And then finally, excess savings. That's always a hard one to talk about, both excess savings and disposable income, because it can be very different across, you know, the income spectrum. Obviously, high inflation is causing pain for lower income people, and they don't have excess savings. But we really have to look at it from a broad top-down economic view, and there is still plenty of disposable income to be spent, and there are still excess savings out there in the economy, and we expect that to continue to be spent. I think we'll see, you know, a moderation in consumer spending, but there's no reason to think that we're going to see a significant pullback in spending, at least over the next couple quarters. With that, the next chart is a good one, just a quick look at where we've been over the last several quarters and where we expect to go in terms of U.S. GDP. So what you've got here is the quarterly GDP growth on an annualized basis. And we started at the fourth quarter of 2020 to really begin to pick up the time where the economy was reopening through where we are today. So the green bars are actual GDP that has occurred, and the gray bars are estimates for the next several quarters. So the one thing I would point out here is, you know, we've been through a period of reopening, of excessive monetary stimulus and excessive fiscal stimulus that has really driven above trend growth. And that dashed line, I'm sorry, is the long-term trend, which is right around 2%. We quickly came out of that, and we're now in a period that will last for some time of probably below trend growth. We did have, as I pointed out earlier, those two quarters of negative GDP growth in the first quarter and second quarter of this year. But it does look like we have some positive momentum in the third quarter, and probably we'll see positive GDP both in the third and the fourth quarter of this year. It gets a little murkier as we get into next year because of the interest rate hikes. The estimates that we're using here show some moderate growth, actually no growth in the first quarter, a very moderate growth in the second, and potential for a little bit higher but moderate growth. I think those estimates could change as we go forward, and the risk of a recession next year is certainly on the rise. This next chart, and I apologize for the fact that there's a lot going on there, but I think it's a really important data series. So this is the Chicago Federal Reserve National Activity Index. Basically what it is a series of 85 different economic indicators that they break out into four different market categories. And you can see those in the key at the bottom. You've got factors that describe production and income, personal consumption and housing, employment, unemployment, sales orders and inventory. So it really gives you a breakdown of the drivers of the overall economy. So there's two things in here that I'll focus on. Let's start with the green line on the chart. That's the overall index value. And you can see the last data point in August is zero. What that's telling us is that the economy through August was growing at trend. So at trend meaning, you know, somewhere, you know, 1.5 to 2% is the long-term trend of economic growth. There are gray dashed lines that you see on here. Those are the bottom line at minus 0.7. That indicates a recession. And the positive line, positive 0.7, when the index is above that, that suggests that the economy is growing so fast that there are concerns about inflationary pressures. We're right square in the middle of that. Anything from minus 0.7 and above means the economy is growing, just not at a typical or above trend rate. Anything above zero says the economy is growing above trend. So the point of this, with a lot of explanation, is just that the economy, we are seeing that number come down. It's bouncing around a little bit month to month, but we are seeing, this is telling us we're at a moderate, close to trend growth currently. We're not at a recessionary level. The bars on here, which are the really busy part of the graph, I mainly wanted to put these in here. This is the contribution to each month's overall index from the different sectors that I just talked about. And the reason I think it's interesting is not to dig into each specific sector, but just how much volatility there has been from month to month in terms of what's contributing positively or negatively to growth. So there's no clear trend across the economy of a sector that's, you know, doing well and continues to do well, or a sector that's showing a decline and continuing to decline. We're seeing variability within the areas of the market, and that really makes it difficult, you know, one, to predict growth for the next quarter, whether it would be positive or negative on the margin, and it's also hard to discern a trend when you've got this much variability in these series. So moving on to the next, I'm going to start digging down in some areas of the market, and we'll start with the labor market because that's something that I pointed out that is a positive that's really supporting the economy today, and something, a reason why we think that we're not in a recession currently. So on the left-hand side of the page, you've got the ratio of job openings to unemployed people. This comes from two different government data series. One being the job openings and labor turnover reports, which is a great name, but it's the acronym for that is JOLTS, which you may have heard of. And then the other piece of data comes from the Labor Department's monthly employment report. So what this does is takes the number of job openings in our economy related to the number of people that are unemployed. So we did just get new data on this chart. So what you have here is through last month, and it showed that for every unemployed person, there were currently about two job openings. That number has come down in the recent data that didn't get into this graph. We're at about 1.7 jobs per unemployed. That came because the number of job openings declined by about 1 million over the last month. So we are seeing that number start to come down. You know, the fact that there are more job openings than people is part of why we're seeing wage pressures. On the margin, a company needs to pay more to get a new employee to come work for them. So as that number comes down, and the number we hope to see, and the Fed certainly hopes that we'll see job openings decline to reduce labor pressure versus having a significant increase in unemployment. The graph on the right-hand side of the page, I think, is really helpful in two ways. One, just to show how much the economy or the labor market has recovered since the pandemic, and the areas of the market that are causing pressure on wages, particularly the service sector. So what you've got here, the green lines being the change in the number of jobs from February of this year relative to February of 2020, or the last, you know, data point before the pandemic shutdowns. And then the gray bars are just August of this year versus that same February of 2020. So at the beginning of this year, we were still about 2 million jobs below pre-pandemic levels. We've closed that gap significantly throughout the year as the labor market has expanded. We're now 270,000 jobs above where we were when the pandemic started. But you can see as you look across the sectors, you know, goods and transportation, financials and information, they've actually seen significant job growth over this time period, while the service-oriented sectors are still below their pre-pandemic levels, particularly leisure and hospitality. And those are the areas, as spending on services has started to increase and demand for services has increased, they're still facing labor shortages in this part, and that has been part of the inflationary pressures that we're seeing across the economy. We've talked a lot in the past about the supply chain. I was going to pull this out, but I think it's great to show how much improvement we've seen over the last 2 years. So this is the New York Fed's Global Supply Chain Pressure Index. And as a reminder, a reading close to zero means the supply chain is acting in a typical or more normalized fashion. And when you move above that, it's the number of standard deviations away from a normal functioning supply chain that you are. So you can see we peaked earlier this year at about just over 4 standard deviations. So that was significant supply chain disruption. And we all seen that when we go to stores and see empty shelves or see prices up on new and used cars because of the lack of supply. As of last month, we're down just about 1.5 standard deviations. So there's still some room for improvement in the supply chain, but we've come a long way. And as the supply chain gets more normalized and demand for goods comes down, that will reduce significantly some inflation pressures in the market. And we'll see that when we look at the next slide. So I thought it would be useful, rather than just talking about overall inflation numbers, to really dig into where we are seeing inflation and where we're seeing inflationary pressures ease. So this is a point in time looking at the August CPI data, the Consumer Price Index. So the column that says August 2022, that shows the year-over-year change for the overall CPI, which is 8.3%. And then it breaks out some of the key components of that CPI data. The columns to the right of that are how today's number compares with the 6-month average year over year change. So that's really getting at shorter and longer term, is the trend in that particular data series towards less inflation or more inflation? And it really is very different as you look across some of these categories. Food inflation, you know, is elevated and it's still rising. And I think anybody who's been in the grocery store will look at your cart and then look at the total on the register and not be surprised at all at the fact that food inflation is up almost 11.5%. Food away from home is also putting pressure on inflation. Some of that is due to the rising costs for restaurants. Not only are their product costs going up, but their labor costs are going up, and that's being passed on to higher prices. You know, energy inflation has actually been reducing overall inflation over the last several months. Energy is always a volatile component in the inflation calculation. And I don't know that we'll continue to see it go down as much as it has, but it'll continue to be volatile. And that's why we often don't look at energy when we're trying to look at trends in overall inflation, because energy is so volatile. I think what's interesting in the middle of the page is the core goods inflation. This is really where our initial inflationary pressures were coming from during the pandemic. Because people were at home, they were buying more houses, they were doing renovations, and the types of products that they were buying and goods that they were buying were in short supply, and that really put pressure on prices. So we saw significant price pressures from this core goods area. As you can see, looking across, you know, things like new vehicles and particularly used vehicles, that is starting to dissipate. And we would expect it to dissipate, to continue to dissipate for two reasons. One, we just talked about the supply chain getting better. And two, people are shifting their spending patterns from buying goods to buying services. And three, as interest rates rise, that will further reduce demand. So that area, which was initially the push of inflation, is starting to ease. The one that's a little more troubling that's on here is the bottom sector, where you have core services, including shelter and rent. We're seeing significant inflationary pressures in rents and cost of building homes. And that trend is still rising. It's 0.7% higher than the average for the last 6 months and 1.5% higher than the average over the last 12 months. So the Fed is certainly paying very close attention to rents and wages because they tend to be stickier and more long-lasting moves in inflation. But we are seeing some signs that these are leveling out. And I don't have wages on here, but wage inflation, while still high, is showing signs of leveling out over the last couple months. So we're very closely watching those sticky components, but we are seeing some signs that inflation, if not falling dramatically now, has at least peaked, and the trend ought to be to lower. And then as Fed rate hikes begin to hit the economy, we should see that come down even more. The other side of inflation that we always talk about is expectations. And expectations are important because they're much more highly correlated with individual spending activity and business activity. People make decisions based on what they think is going to happen to prices in the future and not necessarily what they are now. So here we've just got two different looks at inflation expectations. The New York Fed does a monthly survey, and that gives us a look at one-year inflation expectations and three-year inflation expectations. And again, you can see short-term, the one-year inflation expectations peaked just under 7%, and they're now down to 5.75%. And over a three-year basis, the survey shows that after peaking just over 4%, people now expect inflation to be somewhere around 2.75% over the next 3 years. The right-hand side of the page is the break-even inflation rate embedded in the Treasury Inflation Protected Market, or the TIPS market. I know we've used this chart before. It's a more market-based inflation expectation outlook, but it's showing the same things, different periods. Here we're showing the 2-year and the 10-year, and both of those are coming down significantly and getting closer to the Fed's 2% target. So looking at inflation, I'll turn now and we can talk about the Fed. On the left-hand side of the page is the Fed funds rate. I started it after the end of the financial crisis. So the dark line is actual Fed funds rate and the dashed line is the forecast. This particular forecast, I'm using the median expectation from the Fed. If I were to use a market-based forecast, it would be very similar in terms of pace of rate increase as well as peak terminal Fed funds rate. So, you know, the Fed, I think we all know, was very slow to begin removing emergency accommodation, and that's forced them to have to act very quickly. You know, we've gone from basically zero Fed funds rate at the beginning of the year to 3 to 3.5% now, and likely 4.25 to 4.5% by the end of the year. It's likely that that range that we get to at the end of the year will be the peak of the cycle. But I think what we will see, and it's shown in this graph, is that the Fed is going to want to get to that terminal rate and then keep rates elevated for longer, even if economic data is slowing, even if they risk a recession. They know that in order to truly break inflation, they're going to need to leave those rates higher for longer. And, you know, Chairman Powell has talked about not wanting to cause pain, but needing to cause pain in the economy. And he's also talked a lot about the lessons learned from the 1970s, where the central bank started to ease a little too soon when economic data weakened, and it led to a second spike in inflation that required even more rate hikes afterwards. So I think they're very mindful of history and will try to keep rates elevated for longer. You do see some forecasts for modest rate cuts, but those don't really happen until 2024. On the right-hand side of the page is the Fed's balance sheet, which we know really started to grow during the financial crisis, and then grew even more significantly during the COVID pandemic. They have started to reduce the balance sheet, but it's a very slow process, and based on the estimates that they are, the pace that they're slowing the balance sheet, it will be at about $7.5 trillion by the end of 2023. So that provides some help in fighting inflation, but it's still, from a historic perspective, the Fed's balance sheet is going to remain elevated for quite a long time. So Fed policy obviously impacts interest rates across the curve, but their direct impact is on the front end of the curve. So here, if you look at, we've got the yield to maturity for the Fed funds rate out to the 30-year Treasury. And the lighter green line at the bottom is what yields looked like a year ago. And the gray line at the top is what yields looked like today. And today being last week, they're actually higher out the curve today than they were then. But the green bars are the change in yield over that one-year period. So you can see we've had a significant increase in rates in the front end of the curve in particular. The two-year Treasury is up, you know, 380 basis points. It's actually 15 basis points higher than that today even. I think the other thing that's important in this graph is that it shows, the gray line shows that the yield curve is inverted between the two-year and the 10-year, meaning that the yield on the 10-year Treasury is below that of the two-year. That's not a typical curve shape that we would expect to see. Generally, the further you move out in maturity, the more compensation investors require in terms of yield in order to take more interest rate risk. But when the Fed is raising rates aggressively and the market expects that that will not continue forever, you can get an inversion. You know, inversions are often from twos to tens, can be a signal of a recession. They don't have to be. I think we've had inversions that didn't lead to recessions, but every recession has been preceded by an inversion. So the curve is inverted. It's very inverted today. So that really leads us to the next page, which talks a little bit about yield curve inversions, recessions, and the market. Now, this is all based on historical data. That doesn't mean it's going to happen that way this time, but I think it's helpful to put in context. If you look at the five recession or the five inversions in the top part of the table, on average, the economy goes into recession 20 months following the inversion date. The shortest period time period was 10 months in 1980. And the 81 recession, and the longest was in 2001, where the curve inverted 34 months before. The number of months is probably not as important as just understanding that the inversion doesn't mean an immediate recession. There is a time period between that inversion and the recession. I think the other thing, and again, this is historical, is that from the time of the inversion to the start of the recession, the market can still do well. So it's not the case that because the yield curve inverted that we would expect the market to underperform or be negative going forward. And in fact, in these time periods, the market was up almost 20% cumulatively during that time period. I'm not going to talk in detail about it, but the inversion in 2019 I put separately because I didn't want to leave it out. But I think that the minor yield curve inversion that we saw in 2019 that did not last very long probably wasn't really a signal of the recession that started in February 2020 as we shut down the economy. So I kind of left that one to the side. You might be asking today, where are we in this timeline? So the yield curve inverted 3 months ago on July 5th. So we're 3 months into that time period. From July 5th through last night, the S&P is down 3.3%. And again, I wouldn't put a lot of stock in expecting that we would get averages either in the number of months or the returns, but just to give you a historical perspective on yield curves and recessions. So I know I'm going way over my time. I have two more slides, but I thought before I go to those, because they're more equity market focused, I would just kind of give you a summary of what we've just talked about that's economic related. So despite the two quarters of negative GDP growth, we see momentum in the economy for the remainder of the year, supported by that labor market, by moderating but still positive consumer spending. So we don't think we're in a recession currently, but we do have concerns for next year. We expect that the Fed will continue to raise rates and reduce the balance sheet to stem inflation, even in the face of weaker data. And that obviously raises the recession risk. But even if we do see a recession next year, our belief, because of the fundamentals of our economy, is that that recession would likely be short and shallow. And we don't see the same types of systemic risk in the economy that we saw in the financial crisis. So we don't see that type of systemic problem that exacerbates a recession and turns it into something that's deeper and more long lasting. And I think my final point before we talk about the market a bit is just to reiterate that recessions are part of the business cycle. They're painful for sure, but they also are a positive thing in removing excesses from the market and helping to reallocate capital to more productive and more efficient areas of the market, which then just sets us up for a new market cycle. So moving off of that, and I'll do this quickly, the equity market, you know, we've seen significant volatility this year. The left-hand side of the page is the number of days that the market has traded intraday more than 2%. That number is 65, and that was before the last couple of days, which would take us to probably 68 or so. On average, the market has 33 days a year where we see that type of volatility. And not only are we seeing intraday volatility, we're seeing day-to-day volatility. I mean, this week we had, as you know, we had a strong Monday, a strong Tuesday, and then weakness on Wednesday, weakness on today. And I think the hard thing is that the good days and the bad days tend to come close together. And that really is why we say that timing the market is extremely difficult. And when you shift to the graph on the right-hand side of the page, this really gets at that to be successful over the long term, it's about time in the market and not timing the market. So this data looks at the S&P 500 beginning in January of 1995 and goes through September of this year. So if you were fully invested over that time period, you would have earned 7.8% annually. And if you missed the best 5 days, 10, 20, and on down, you can see that return goes down pretty dramatically. So if you couldn't predict when those best 5 days were going to occur and tried to time the market, your return would decline pretty significantly, to the point that over 27-year time period, if you missed the 50 best days in the market, you would actually have an annualized return of minus 1.7%. We can look, and I know we've used this chart before, we can look at drawdowns and market volatility in a different way. This is the annual return. The bars are the annual return of the S&P 500, and the diamonds are the annual drawdown. So from peak to trough within a year, what did the market do? And you can see most years have some type of drawdown. Some are worse than others. This year, the peak to trough is down about 23, almost 24%. We are still obviously down for the year, and that number is a little different today than when I put this graph together. But the point being that drawdowns are a normal part of the market, but negative returns are much rarer. They do occur. They generally don't occur in consecutive years, other than we saw that from 2000 and 2002. But generally, markets tend to recover. They move rapidly to price in changing expectations for changing market environments or economic environments, but that they tend to recover before the economy recovers. So the last point I want to make on this, and I know I'm about 5 minutes from my end here, is taking all of this stuff that I said about the market, what does that mean for your portfolio? Our growth and our income portfolios are defensively positioned. They're diversified, not only across sectors of the market, but across names. And the idea is that we focus on large, high-quality companies that are leaders in their market. And the reason why a market-leading company is important is when inflation is high, they have more pricing power, they're financially flexible, able to pull different levers to deal with any near-term weakness without having to sacrifice investment and long-term growth. And, you know, some of our companies are more impacted by higher inflation than others, to be sure. And some of our companies are underperforming the market quite a bit, and others are outperforming the market quite a bit. And that's where combined that diversification really matters. But from a research perspective, what we continue to focus on is, what is the company doing? How are they dealing with near-term inflation or whatever slowing demand for their products, if that's the case? And how are they positioned for the future? Can they still invest for future growth? Once we get through a difficult economic period, are the growth drivers that we identified when we purchased the company still in place? And as long as that's the case, that's what we're going to focus on. If we believe that a company cannot get through this period without significantly damaging its future prospects, then we would absolutely sell that company immediately. So, you know, we just, in times of trouble, we really try to emphasize and remind you of those principles that we use in all market environments, but they're especially important today. You know, when volatility, we do these things all the time, but when volatility is high, we try to take profits on companies that are doing well even more readily to make sure that we're locking in those gains. And the other thing is, you know, we're spending some time now looking at opportunities in the market to maybe add some new names to the portfolio. There's certainly other good companies out there that meet the criteria that we've talked about, that have seen their stock prices decline far beyond what their fundamental outlook should be. So, you know, we may make some changes to the portfolio this quarter really to take advantage of those dislocations and, you know, particularly in our income portfolio, maybe be able to enhance the yield of that portfolio. And finally, for those of you that do have some fixed income allocation, you've probably noticed that we've been very aggressively buying bonds in the fixed income ladder. We're focusing on short maturities and high quality corporate bonds, but we're pretty excited that for the first time in a while, we can provide some diversification from equity risk while providing incremental yield. And with the understanding that, you know, it's very unusual this year that both bond and stock prices are down, We've mitigated some of that by the short duration of our corporate bond ladder. But the other important thing to remember is that we hold those bonds to maturity. So these short-term price fluctuations will work themselves out. And when the bond matures, you will get your principal back and we'll reinvest it in whatever area is most attractive. So, you know, to kind of close it all up, it's volatile times, it's difficult times, and, you know, we certainly understand investor anxieties, but our focus is on risk management and positioning the portfolios to minimize the downside risk, but making sure that we're staying invested to help you meet your long-term goals. So with that, in just a few minutes, I will turn it back to Michael for any questions.
All right. Thank you, Jean. Well, I want to be mindful of everybody's time and be respectful of everybody's time. So I think we're going to go ahead and end on time, which is right now. And anyone who did submit a question either beforehand that Jean wasn't able to address during her presentation or during the presentation, we will make sure that we reach out individually and get you the answers to those questions so that you're not left wondering. And we will do that as soon as we possibly can. If any questions came up from anyone in attendance during the presentation that they didn't have a chance to ask, go ahead and send those to your advisor, send them to Jean, and we'll make sure we get those answered right away as well. But with that, we're going to go ahead and close the presentation. Thank you, everybody, for your time. Thank you for your continued support of us, and thank you for continuing to allow us to serve you, serve your investment needs, and take care of the finances of you and your family. So we will see you guys soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.